Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Emergency Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European and RZVS recognised specialist in small animal surgery, Alison Moores. Thank you, Alison. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much to those of you who are joining us today and anyone who's listening later on. So I'm talking to you today about managing complications of surgery, and in this we're going to talk about how to avoid complications and how to manage them. And I'm going to concentrate really on the general complications we see with just a few specific examples. Obviously, we're not going to have time to run over every possible outcome that we could come across. So when I consider complications, the first thing I want to think about before I do any procedure is what complications can be expected. And that's important because if we anticipate complications, actually we may be able to prevent them happening. But also importantly, if those complications happen, then we know to be looking for them. If we know something exists, we keep our minds on particular things in the postoperative period and think, actually, could this be happening? I may go specifically looking for it. Think about what complications can be avoided. So can we avoid making silly, careless mistakes? So we'll avoid the major complications there that we can get around. But also there may be some complications that can't be avoided in every single case. So there will always be some wound dehiscence and some infection. We also want to have an idea of how frequently complications will occur. So we have an idea of whether we are creating more complications than everybody else. So we can look at the published literature, see what the complication rate is, and it's very useful to actually periodically do a review of your own cases and do an audit and keep a record of percentage of dehiscences and percentage of infections, because if you do have a higher rate of infections than is reported in the literature, then you can go back to your practice and try to work out why. I think one of the most important things for me is to know that owners are fully informed. So before any procedure, I will talk in detail about what complications can occur and what the frequency is, and we need to set those against the benefits for the animal of having the procedure. So the owner needs to know the benefits of doing something, weigh it against the risks, and knowing how serious a complication may be and how likely it is to happen. And it's very, very important to take the time to get owner consent, and for the more major procedures, it may take us somewhere between 10, 15, 20 minutes to get that owner consent. And it's very important to do so because actually that's one of the biggest areas of complaints that we as vets have against us, is if a complication occurs, the owner says they didn't know about it. We also want to know how we can recognise complications and treat them. So how do we recognise the dog who has a breakdown of the gastrointestinal incision and has septic peritonitis? How might we treat it if that occurs? And again, we talk to the owners about that. And I try to always be very proactive when cases aren't progressing as expected. So if something's not right, rather than just thinking, oh, well, it'll probably get better later, I will say to myself, okay, what complication might have occurred? How can I go looking for it? And then if it has occurred, I will have caught that complication earlier, and so hopefully my outcome will be better. So it's helpful to have a little bit of paranoia as a surgeon as to thinking things may have gone wrong. So the first thing to say is we need to avoid the simple mistakes, because it's hard enough dealing with the complications that can occur even if we do everything correctly without actually making life harder for ourselves. So an example here is making sure that if you use swabs during your surgical procedures, as most of us will do, to make sure we've got them all. So we always count the swabs at the start of the surgery, and I've got a whiteboard attached to the wall in my theatre, and I write down how many swabs I've been used, and those are the large laparotomy swabs and the small 10x10 swabs, so that if we have a change in personnel, then I will know how many swabs I've been given. The picture you see here on the right is an example of a surgical swab that's been retained within the pelvis after a procedure, and that's being removed some months later from the abscess cavity. It's also useful to use swabs that have got x-ray markers on them. So if there is a question about whether a swab has been left behind, then you will be able to see it on radiography afterwards. If you're not using them already, then it's worth using the surgical safety checklist. And this is used a lot in the human field. It came from aviation. And it's been shown that this is the single factor that has been shown to reduce deaths across the developed and the developing world in human medicine. So it's the biggest innovation that there has been in decades, and it's massively reduced death rates by up to a third. So it's a little bit frustrating when you're starting to implement checklists because not everybody is on board. People may not be enthusiastic because they feel they take too much time, but actually it only takes a minute or two to implement each stage of the checklist. And these are here so that the simple aspects of human error will hopefully be reduced. So if we have a look at this checklist, and this has been produced by the AHT, and you can print these off and use them yourselves, or you can devise your own. We start off in our practice by using the checklist before induction of anaesthesia. So we make sure we've got the correct patient and that we know what surgical site we're using. So if you're doing an orthopaedic procedure, you need to make sure you've got the correct leg. Checks for your nurses to make sure that they've actually set up correctly. Make sure that we have known allergies or drugs we can't use. So for example, some animals may not be able to have non-steroidals. Is this going to be a difficult airway? So do we have a bulldog, for example? And are we worried about blood loss? Then we need to check that whether we're going to get the patient in the right position, are we giving antibiotics, and does everybody know what they're doing? So that's what we do before we induce anaesthesia. Then, prior to cutting the animal for the first time, again, we check we've got the right animal and that we've got the correct procedure. And then we talk through all of the potential complications that may arise. And there may not be very many, for example, in a spay. But if I was going to do a liver lobectomy, then I might be worried about, for example, blood loss. I'd want to make sure I've got the correct equipment available before we start, because if it's not ready, someone can be looking for it. And is there anything we particularly need the anaesthetist to know? So are we going to be leaning on the vena cava or opening the chest? So we'll go through all of these checklists here. And then in the post-operative period, we need to make sure that we've actually done everything. So an example would be making sure that you've taken all the biopsies that you needed to, counting the swabs back again, and being very, very careful to do that on every single procedure you do. And then finally, the big important one for me is making sure that we've actually labelled any samples we're taking and make sure they've gone back to the laboratory. And then we'll talk through things that we need to think about in the post-operative period. So as with human medicine, if you use your checklists, you will reduce human error significantly and you will really, really decrease the morbidity and the mortality of your patients. You'll have many fewer complications to deal with. Okay, so I generally like to think about what common complications I'm going to come across, and I will always go through these with the owner to get owner consent. So this is my basic list of concerns I have. Concerns with the general anaesthetic, particularly regurgitation, but I will also mention anaesthetic death because that will occur occasionally. Animals will commonly regurgitate under anaesthetic. Studies that have looked at orthopaedic patients and examined the pH of the esophagus showed a significant number of them were regurgitating during the procedure, even if they were regurgitating silently. So we need to be proactive in the management of regurgitation if it occurs to make sure that we don't have long-term problems. We worry about drug reactions, and they may be known reactions or they may be adverse reactions. So in particular, we need to be careful with animals who may have had problems with non-steroidals in the past. We may need to think about not using those. And then hemorrhage, infection and wound breakdown are really the main three complications of every surgical procedure I would do, and also death. So that may be an unexplained death or a death related to a complication or related to the animal's condition. And for that, I would certainly want to give the owner an idea of the risk of death. So I would hope to be able to say this is a low risk of death, but then there may be some procedures we do where we know that the post-operative survival is quite poor, for example, septic peritonitis. So let's look at how I might approach and think about complications for individual surgeries I do. If I'm thinking about intestinal surgery, I don't think the anaesthetic risk is any higher than any other animal, but I am particularly concerned about the risk of infection and wound breakdown, because we know that intestinal wounds have somewhere between a 2 and a 20% dehiscence rate. The 2% dehiscence rate is from a new study that's been done that was presented at AVSTS this year, looking at dehiscence from intestinal biopsies, and that was shown to actually be very low as compared to previous papers that have suggested it's quite high. But enterotomies and enterectomies can have dehiscence rates as high as 20%, and those animals will have septic peritonitis, and even with aggressive surgery and medical treatment, there's only a 50% chance of survival if an animal gets septic peritonitis. So that's really the main part of owner consent I talked through for intestinal surgery. For an ovarian hysterectomy or an ovariectomy, then actually most of the complications that can occur should have a very, very low risk. So that's something that's important to say to the owner. That's why I've put them in grey here, to show that these risks aren't high, but they do occur. And if you were to review thousands or tens of thousands of spay procedures, then you will see that there are episodes of hemorrhage and wound breakdown from the linear alba, damage to abdominal organs, failure to remove all ovarian tissue. So we do need to let owners know that there is a risk of complication, even if it's low. Similarly, for mast cell tumour resection, I may be thinking about various risks and complications, but in particular, if I've done a large resection, I'm going to be worrying about dehiscence of that wound, particularly if it's under tension and therefore infection. So those are the things I will particularly have talked to that client about. So it's always important, if you're going to avoid a complication, to try and think about it in advance and say, well, actually, what complications may occur if I do this? Is this the best procedure to do? Is there an alternative? Or actually, am I going to still go ahead with my plan, but be aware of what may happen as I go through? So we look at this dog here, and there's a very large mass dorsal to the anus. You can see that it's very inflamed and it's ulcerated. And in this particular case, there was no alternative to surgical procedure for it, but this wound is going to be under tension. Because it's close to the anus, it's at a high risk of infection. And if we look at the dog in the post-operative period, you can see that there has indeed been wound dehiscence, and you get the impression here that that wound is probably infected as well. So this dog's likely to come back into hospital for a period of open wound management, and that's going to be distressing for the dog and the owner, and it's potentially going to be expensive as well. So we need to have preempted that complication so that the owner is ready for it if it occurs. And also, some owners may say they are not prepared to go through this complication, and you would know therefore that that patient and that owner are not candidates for surgery. We want to minimise adding problems to our surgical cases, so we need to make sure these animals are stable for anaesthesia. And this generally is going to be more for the animals who are ill rather than those who are presenting for their spay procedure. So if we have a look at the videos, one of the things that I want to know is whether these animals are normovolemic. So this dog has got a fairly normal capillary refill time, a couple of seconds in length, and I'm also going to feel pulse rates and pulse quality and lots of other factors to determine if I think that case is stable. If we put the next video on now, we're seeing some examples of hypovolemia. So we may see a very quick capillary refill time. As we're seeing here, it's much less than a second, and this animal's in early compensatory hypovolemia. Or we may see a more prolonged capillary refill time. And these cases that I'm showing here will be the septic peritonitis cases. So either a very quick or a very slow capillary refill time. So here is this is the slow refill time. So we're seeing that's taking 3 or 4 seconds. And this animal is likely to have, again, poor pulses, maybe bradycardic, and maybe hypothermic. So for animals either in a compensatory or in a decompensatory state of hypovolemia, we need to get those animals fit for anaesthesia to reduce our complication rate. Okay, so the first complication that I tend to worry about is hemorrhage. Now, that hemorrhage may occur during the surgical procedure. And here's an example of what I look like after I've finished a maxillectomy or a mandibulectomy. And that's because sometimes we just hit large blood vessels. So in this case, I've got a mandible. This is one side of the mandible, and here's the other side. And in this area here, we have a large artery and vein that go through the mandibular canal. And we know that we're always going to hit that when we are cutting through that bone, and then we will have to deal with that vessel afterwards. It's always nice to find blood vessels before we cut them, but it doesn't always happen, and sometimes we do find ourselves faced with hemorrhage during the surgical procedure. So we need to think ahead about how we're going to deal with those. So in an ideal world, if you're doing advanced surgery, then you need to have a vessel sealing device or an electrocoagulation device. So we've got a diathermy unit here at the bottom. And I think without those, it's very difficult to do many of the more advanced surgical procedures because a lot of the blood vessels are quite short and in difficult locations. So they are more difficult to get mosquito forceps on until ligate. However, the mosquitoes are a nice alternative for subcutaneous tissues if you don't have a diathermy available. And obviously, if you don't have diathermy available, then you're going to be doing an awful lot more ligation. But we need to be very, very particular about how we manage hemostasis during every surgical procedure. Large blood vessels may not look very big in an animal who's under anesthesia, particularly if they're hypovolemic, but those vessels, if they are not correctly ligated or sealed or coagulated, will cause hemorrhage in the postoperative period. Hemostatic agents such as cellulose or collagen are useful for tissues such as the liver, which will bleed from the capillary bed or other capillary bleeds. They won't be helpful in the face of an arterial or a venous bleed. So some animals will present in the postoperative period and they're quite obviously hemorrhaging. So here we have a dog who's had a median sternotomy. So this is the sternal wound here. We see a lot of bruising around the tissues, and you can see that someone's just put a pad underneath that wound to catch the hemorrhage, and that's bleeding reasonably vigorously. So we know that there is some uncontrolled hemorrhage within that surgical site. But it's not always obvious externally, and it may not always present in the way you think. So here we have a bitch who's had an ovariohysterectomy, and her hemorrhage is coming from one of the uterine vessels, but it's bleeding internally. So the hemorrhage is going into the base of the uterus and out through the vagina. So we're seeing a lot of hemorrhage from here, and that's an indication in this animal that we need to go in and operate. But sometimes we won't see external hemorrhage. It may all remain contained within the abdominal cavity with your postoperative spay bleeds or bleeds from any other surgical procedure. So in a situation like this, we can have a large amount of bleeding, but we won't be able to tell externally from the wound. And in those situations, we need to be looking at how the animal presents to us. So if we've had a dog who's had a spay earlier on in the day and is either still in the hospital or has gone home and comes back with pale mucous membranes and is tachycardic and has either bounding pulses or weak pulses, that says to us that this animal is having a bleed because it's unlikely to be anything else. We can diagnose that with ultrasound, but if we put a needle into the abdomen, then we would expect to see a large amount of blood in this case here. And then there's no question that the animal should go back to theatre. There's no point giving blood products as a sole means of treatment in an animal who has an ovarian vessel or a uterine vessel that is actively bleeding. And I think it's quite difficult for some practitioners, particularly I found when I was a new graduate, making the decision about whether to go back in. But I think if an animal presents to you and is hypovolemic after a spay, then we know that we do need to reoperate. So this is an example of what we may see. We're looking here down at the uterine stump. So here we have the bladder, caudally, and we can see active hemorrhage in this area. If your bleeding is coming from the ovary, then it's very useful to make a much bigger incision than you would have done from your original spay because you've actually got to get down now to where that bleeding vessel is. So trying to do it through your small centimeters of incision isn't going to work. So you need to have this animal prepped to be able to operate from xiphoid to stern, so xiphoid to pubis if necessary, and you will need a big incision. There's going to be a lot of blood and it will be difficult to see what's going on. Now, what I've done here, if we look at this case, this is the duodenum. We can see the pancreas sitting within it, and you can have an assistant lift the duodenum up for you, and then you'll find the kidney down here. And in this animal, we do have still an intact ovary and uterus, and this is where the suspensory ligament is with the ovarian vessels in them. So if you find that there's a lot of pooling of blood in this area and you can't see what you're doing, then you need an assistant to pull the duodenum out of the way. You need to find the caudal pole of the kidney, and that's where you'll find your blood vessel. Similarly, if we have a problem with the left ovary, then we'll lift the colon up, find the caudal pole of the kidney, and then the ovarian vessel will be down in there. They can be very difficult to ligate, particularly if that vessel is very, very small. So it's useful to have a diathermy unit. If you don't have one, then you will need to find a way of getting mosquito clamp on it, and the wider your incision, the easier you'll find it to actually place that ligature. But I would recommend that you always have an assistant with you if you're dealing with a major postoperative bleed. This is an example of another dog who has a bleed from down around the ovary. So we've got the bladder retracted caudally here, and here's the urethra. You can see a very large blood clot in this region here, and you can see evidence that there's been a lot of blood in there, and this clot needs to be removed before we can find the source of the bleeding. If you've opened the animal up, then I would always take the blood clot off. I know that some people will say that that clot is stopping bleeding, but actually, if it's bled to the point where the animal is hypovolemic, then I really, really would like to get a ligature on that blood vessel. And then just going back to the dog I showed you a few slides ago, where the bladder was pulled caudally and we had that pool of blood in here, you can now see this was the stump of the uterus, and then I've individually ligated the uterine vessels to stop them bleeding. In animals who have a large uterus, if you'd put a ligating ligature all the way around and you don't individually ligate these vessels, then you will find you have a higher risk for hemorrhage, because you can't get an encircling or a transfixing ligature tight enough around a large uterus and be able to actually compress those blood vessels completely. So I always individually ligate those uterine vessels and then put a ligature around or transfixing through the uterus or the cervix or wherever you choose to remove the uterus at. Okay, so sometimes we see hemorrhage present as bruising. So we will see it from traumatic injury. So sometimes we have a lot of bruising because the animal had an underlying trauma that we operated on, or it may just be excess surgical trauma. And we see in the example here, we have a huge amount of bruising associated with this laparotomy. But if you see this tube here, this animal has got a cystostomy tube in, and so some of this bruising may have been related to urine leakage. This degree of bruising will resolve with time, but we can help it along by using cold compresses. And what we hope to find is within a few days or a week, then that bruising will have resolved. Bruising of this extent would be unusual to be seen in our post-surgical patients, but we may see it in trauma cases. So this is a dog who's been involved in a trauma around the abdominal cavity. So you might see this with dog bite wounds, or you might see it with a road traffic accident. And so we're going to have a lot more bruising postoperatively in our trauma patients. But again, that will resolve given time. This dog has had a partial zygomatic arch resection, and in the immediate postoperative period, this incision line looked very clean and nice. But over a period of a few hours, we can see a lot of swelling around the eye. You can see the conjunctiva here, obviously swollen so the dog can't open the eye. We've got a huge amount of bruising here. So this is 12 hours postoperatively. And this degree of bruising wasn't surprising because I knew what we'd gone through in order to get the zygomatic arch out. So we managed that postoperatively by keeping the dog in hospital for a little longer than normal so we can cold compress him and make sure he's comfortable before he goes home to the owners. Going back to this dog, just need to be aware of complications of hemorrhage that we have in greyhounds and some similar breeds. So these animals can have problems with forming a healthy clot, and they can have excessive fibrinolysis. So we see them with normal clotting parameters if we test them beforehand, and they seem to form normal clots at the time of surgery, but then they will have delayed bleeding. So we need to be very careful prior to doing any surgery in greyhounds or sighthounds, and there are some blood tests that can be run, although not easily commercially available or in-house, but you can do blood tests, and you can talk to your lab about those. And it's useful to think about pre-treating these animals with a drug called tranexamic acid, which will try to stabilize the clot, although it still won't prevent bleeding in all cases. Just to briefly mention other spay complications and how to deal with them, sometimes we will see a retained ovary or an ovarian remnant. So either an entire ovary has been left behind at the time of spay or part of it. And these are actually very, very uncommon for the number of spay procedures that are being done in the UK. We tend to find that if we look at the histories for these animals, it tends to be in animals where the spay was difficult. So the animal may have been very fat, or there may have been bleeding during the procedure that made it difficult to see what's going on. So just a reminder to make sure that you do have enough visualization during your procedure to make sure you have got the ovary out in its entirety. And it may mean that you need a larger incision. You may want to use abdominal retractors. And if you don't have abdominal retractors available, you might want to have another vet scrub in just to help you find that ovary. Post-operatively, these animals will keep coming back into season. And so that's generally the way we diagnose them. There are blood tests that you can do, so you can talk to the lab about sending off some blood tests. Usually we will find on ultrasound that they are easily recognizable, and my experience in surgery is that they are usually generally easy to find because there's usually quite a large piece of ovarian tissue left behind. So post-operative treatment for these will just be another laparotomy and to go and remove that ovarian tissue. A bigger complication is damage to the ureters during a spay procedure, and again this tends to be done or occur as a complication if we have a lot of bleeding, so it's difficult to see what's going on, or it may occur during doing a procedure through an incision that's too small. And it can occur at various locations. Here we have the bladder and we have the ureter coming off it, and you can see how that's been ligated here up by the kidney. And this may occur if the ureter is confused for potentially the uterus in a very small animal, or probably more likely the broad ligaments in dogs. We may alternatively see it ligated further distally, so here it is down by the bladder. And what we can see here is the other end of where it was, and you just get the impression of a very large kidney here. And unfortunately, the only way to deal with this complication post-operatively, if it's a long way down the line, is to take the kidney out. Because in this example we see here, this is from the animal you've just seen in the previous photograph. This is a hydronephrotic kidney, and this is the hydroureter associated with it. So we have no kidney function left in this animal. And the reason that the animal is going to develop hydronephrosis without us knowing about it is because the animal has obviously two kidneys. And if the other kidney hasn't been damaged, then you can ligate a ureter and it will be a silent complication. It's possible that you may know that you have ligated or transected the ureter. The options then may be to, obviously if you've just ligated it, you can take that ligature off and hope that the ureter will function normally. Unfortunately, ureters don't cope very well with crushing injury, but it may be okay. If you've transected it, then you may choose to remove the kidney in an owner who doesn't want to pursue things further. But it is possible to rescue a kidney where the ureter has been transected. So it depends upon the size of the animal. Obviously, in larger animals, technically it is possible to suture the ureter back together, or to suture the ureter to the bladder, although we can have problems with stricture formation. But we can also place a sub-device, so that's a subcutaneous ureteric bypass system. And so this is a way to keep the kidney by placing this implant. And it's generally been recognised as a treatment for ureteral stones, but it has its place in those cases where we've had damage to the ureter during the spay. Okay, so moving on to the next typical complication that I worry about, surgical site infection and or dehiscence. And we'll start off by thinking about the skin. So the case example we have here, we have a hind limb amputation, we've got some dehiscence of our surgical site here, and we've had necrosis of some skin here, with infection. So dehiscence and infection will generally occur together. We don't often know what the primary cause is if we see these animals sometime down the line. But if we see the animals as soon as a complication has become apparent, we might be able to tell which it is. So we always need to think about other causes of dehiscence. We don't want to blame everything on infection, but it's important to know why a wound may have dehisced so that we can correct that problem. So it may be that there's too much tension on the wound. So we may have had to have undermined our wound quite a lot to get the edges together. And then we know that we need to reduce the tension on that wound so that it doesn't dehisce again. If the wound was tight and you sutured it together and it dehisced, if you just do another primary closure on it, that wound is going to dehisce again because there's too much tension on it. And we also know that inflamed wounds will be more likely to dehisce. So we're kind of asking for that wound to keep on breaking down unless we deal with the tension. We can think about factors we can manage at home, so we can make sure that the animal's not moving around too much. We can use our buster collars to make sure the animal doesn't chew its sutures out. And we also need to think about how much swelling we have around the wound. So we need to try and avoid seroma and hematoma formation by reducing dead space and controlling bleeding, because in cases where a wound is already under tension, if we add a seroma into the mix, then we will find that our wound will dehisce. And finally, animals who've had previous radiation therapy will not heal normally. So we need to be very careful to avoid doing surgery in those cases. So if I've got a post-operative infection or a dehiscence, then I want to think about what factors are involved in having caused that, and so what sort of things do I need to overcome. So there may be a nidus from infection, and in those cases, just treating the superficial infection isn't going to resolve the problem. So animals may have an orthopaedic implant and they can then get a surgical site infection for anywhere up to a year post-operatively. So if we have recurrent abscesses or sinus formations overlying a plate, then we know that ultimately we need to take that plate away, we need to take that plate off when the fracture has healed so that we don't keep getting infections. It's reported that infections can occur associated with suture material and meshes. My experience generally is that sutures don't tend to propagate infections, but I do use a monofilament suture at all times just to try and avoid that as a risk. And we may have trauma-related debris as well. So if we had an open wound and we didn't manage to remove all of the necrotic material or any of the debris that came from a shearing injury, and we've got road dirt in there, if we don't get all of that out, then we may get a surgical site infection. And the books talk about residual neoplasia causing dehiscence of wounds. My experience is generally that that is much less of a risk factor than actually failing to remove necrotic tissue and controlling tension. There may be patient factors as well. So traumatic tissues are much more likely to dehisce and to become infected than a healthy wound. So we might want to think about delaying a repair of dehisced tissue until the inflammation of the surrounding skin has reduced, and just to make sure that all the infection is under control. And also have a think about pre-existing diseases that may make the animal heal slower. So our cushionoid dogs or any animal that's on steroids is likely to have reduced healing. And then finally, there's the things that we really can control, our surgical factors, many of which will be down to, unfortunately, poor decision-making. So we may have failed to lavage and debride a wound correctly before we close it. We may have closed the wound too early. We might not have employed the tension-relieving techniques. And so when we're trying to work out how to manage a wound that's dehisced, we need to try and recognise the reason why that occurred so that we can avoid making the same mistake again. This video is just to serve as a reminder that we can very much reduce the incidence of surgical site infections by thinking carefully about hand hygiene practices. We make sure that we always wash our hands between every single patient and every procedure we do. The reason this is not always done well in practice is twofold. One is failure to have enough stations for hand hygiene. So if you don't have a sink in your ward, then you can't expect your nurses to be remembering to wash their hands between every single patient and every procedure that they do. So you can have sterilizing units on the walls, or your nurses can carry around little sprays that they can have on their pockets. And the same for vets as well. We always need to make sure that we have very, very good hand hygiene, and that will reduce our surgical site infection rates. We need to think carefully about cross-contamination between our patients. So if you have an animal in the hospital that has an infection, either because it's come in with it or because it's got a surgical site infection, or the animal may have severe diarrhea and so will have a high bacterial burden, we want to make sure that we are not cross-contaminating our individual patients. So we need to recognise those animals that need to be barrier nursed, and in our hospital that will include any animal who's got an open wound. So to protect the individual animal from a hospital acquired infection, but also to avoid any other animals nearby getting infected. So we don't want this animal who's got an open wound to be treated by a nurse who then moves on to our dog who's just had a fracture repair. So we want to make sure we separate these animals and have good hygiene practices. So let's have a look at some case examples. This is a dog who has had a lateral wall resection, and you can see some dehiscence here on one side of the cartilage. And if I were to say what I thought had occurred here, I'd probably say it's most likely that this is an infection that has led to a dehiscence, just because I know that this surgery involved dirty tissues and very, very inflamed tissues by the nature of the disease process. I don't think that there was excessive tension here, and I don't think the surgical procedure was done badly. So there's not a lot to change here, other than we want to get the infection under control and we want to get the tissues healthy, and we can then go on and resuture that wound or potentially even leave that to heal by second intention. This is an example of a dog who's got tissue necrosis and infection, and while this isn't a post-operative case, you can see how as soon as you start to get tissue necrosis and pus forming, that we start to get death of tissues and tissues that will open up, and ultimately we can end up with a large amount of dehisced tissue. And sometimes we may have recognised that the dehiscence came first, so we may have seen a wound that dehisced and was looking healthy, but unless we start to think about managing that wound to keep it healthy looking and to stop it getting contaminated with bacteria, that will ultimately lead to an infection, and an infection could lead to necrosis and loss of a large amount of skin. So we need to be very proactive in managing our dehiscence cases as well. So one of the things I want to think about when I'm managing a case is to decide whether a mass is going to be under tension after I've removed it. So this comes back to pre-surgical planning. So here we have a sarcoma, low-grade sarcoma, that needs to be removed. So it's just on the shoulder of a Doberman, and we're having a good feel around just to get an impression of how much skin there is there, and is that wound going to heal after we remove it. Here we're doing a recurrent fibrosarcoma resection, and we need to remove a reasonable amount of tissue. Actually, you can see that overlying the scapulae of the cat, there's actually an awful lot of tissue. So even though we're going to remove a lot of tissue, we will actually be able to get that wound closed. And so this is our cat in the post-operative period, and that wound's not under any tension at all. And that's important, because if this wound dehisses, then it's going to cause an awful lot of problems, because it's a very large wound, it's very long, it will end up being very wide if it dehisses, and it will expose the scapulae, and this cat will not heal without a second surgery. And sometimes I just don't know which came first, whether it was infection or dehiscence, so we'll try to manage both at the same time. So this is an orthopaedic case. You can see that there's some necrosis overlying the carpus and overlying the plate. We can also see that the toes are very swollen. So this skin is causing a constriction in this area, and this dog grew a clostridial infection. And you can see that the consequences are really looking quite devastating, because we've got loss of all of this tissue and we're going to end up with the plate being exposed. And unfortunately, there's nothing we can do in this case other than a very, very intense period of open wound management. And ultimately, this dog did heal by second intention, but in these situations, it's likely that the plate is going to have to be removed because there will probably be some residual infection around the plate. So these cases can be very difficult to deal with. So I've got a video here that's showing a case that we treated in a dog who had a mast cell resection from the tail, and that was closed primarily. So it looks like it's running well. Apologies for that. So this dog had a mast cell tumour removed. It was closed primarily and then it dehisced. So this dog is being managed over a period of weeks with open wound management because we'd recognised that there was too much tension on the wound, and having failed to heal once by primary closure, it's going to fail to heal again. And we don't have any other option other than second intention healing in this area. So every day that we see this dog initially, we do lavage. So you can see here that I've got a three-way tap connected to a fluid pump. So just on the left hand, you can see a giving set that's going to go off to a bag of fluids, and a 20ml syringe and a green needle will give you just the right pressure of lavage. Don't push too hard on that syringe because you may end up forcing debris further into the wound. So we're basically trying to flush away any bacteria, any neutrophils and other debris from cells, and physical debris that will have come from the wound as it was undergoing its necrosis. So we do this with large volumes of fluid every day, and then I will often surgically debride any abnormal tissue that is not coming away easily. If it doesn't come away in the dressings, then I like to actually remove that tissue because it will speed up healing. Now this dog is conscious and I'm just cutting away tissue that's dead, which is why the dog is lying perfectly still and allowing me to do this. I don't cut away tissue that isn't dead because we may need that for the animal to heal. So if it's not obviously dead, it stays behind and we'll find out tomorrow whether it's dead or the day after. So we just debride what we need to. And then we go back to flushing. So this is on another day. You can see that the same system is being used again. We've got the three-way tap and the syringe and the giving set. And now we have no more necrosis in the wound, but we're flushing away bacteria, bacterial toxins, and any small necrotic products that there are there. Always using gloves. And they don't need to be sterile gloves if you're not touching the actual wound. But if you were touching within the wound, then you would need to use sterile gloves. And we're just demonstrating here that there is far too much tension on this wound to consider doing any sort of surgical closure. So if we try to put sutures in that, that will break open again. So this dog can only be managed by second intention healing. There's a large choice of dressings that you can use. We use a lot of honey for its antibacterial properties. And you can either buy honey impregnated dressings, or you can buy honey tubes, as you saw we used here, and we put that on the alevin. It's much better to put it on the dressing rather than on the granulation tissue, because granulation tissue is quite slippery and the honey does have a tendency to slide off. And then we have our typical three layers of bandage. We can manage this animal as an outpatient. And eventually we will have owners managing these wounds themselves. So we will teach owners how to apply dressings. We'll teach them how to, excuse me, use the honey. And if we do have an owner managing a wound at home, then we will follow up with photographs. So I like to see a picture every week of the dog to check it's doing okay. And you just see here, this was the dog lying very still. She's managing to have her dressings changed, conscious. Sometimes we'll see multi-drug resistant infections. And coming back to what I was saying earlier about owner consent and information, if I have a situation where I know that there is a high risk for infection, and particularly for a multi-drug resistant infection, I go through it at the time of first consultation. So if I'm presented with a dog who has a dehisced wound, or bite wounds, or road traffic accident wounds, that I know is going to spend a number of weeks in hospital, or potentially at home, but in particular in hospital, we will talk through what it means to get a hospital-acquired infection and a multi-drug resistant infection. And it just makes your life so much easier if you have had the conversation that involves MRSA and MRSP in advance, so that the owner knows that you thought about it and you anticipated it, because then if you have to inform the owner that we're dealing with an MRSA or an MRSP, it's a little bit easier to have that conversation when they were potentially expecting it. So if we do have a multi-drug resistant infection and the animal can be managed on an outpatient basis, then it's a lot easier to do so. It's very difficult to isolate animals and prevent infection going to other animals in the hospital, and the treatment it will have to have will be a lot more expensive just because the disinfection processes are a lot more intense. So we need to use as much disposable equipment as possible. So we'll use gloves, we'll use the little cardboard food bowls and litter trays. We need completely separate equipment so that when the patient finally leaves the hospital, we can clean those. And we need to make sure that we treat other animals first if we have an inpatient with a multi-drug resistant infection. Or if we're going to see it as an outpatient, we want to make sure we see it at the end of our clinics. There will be different cleaning products that will be working at any particular moment in time. So you can talk to your drug reps about making sure that your disinfectants are going to be effective against multi-drug resistant infections. And make sure you are very good with your hand hygiene. Always use sterile gloves when you're handling any wound. So not just the ones that have already got the multi-drug resistant infection, but any wound, if you touch it, you need to make sure you're wearing sterile gloves so you don't introduce an infection, and minimize catheter use so that we don't get our MRSA or MRSP infection then going into urinary catheters and IV catheters. Our antibiotics are based on culture and sensitivity. We'll often find a single antibiotic that is useful, but because we do find these cases difficult to manage and difficult to find an antibiotic that's effective, if the multi-drug resistant infection is in a skin or a subcutaneous wound, then we need to be much more reliant on our wound management techniques. So debridement of necrotic tissue, lavage, and this is when you might find the honeys useful, and potentially even maggot therapy. In terms of owner advice, we do not make any suggestions about their health, but we do need to ask them if they're immunosuppressed, and those people in particular need to go and talk to their doctors. It is a little bit difficult as vets, because doctors do have a tendency to say you shouldn't have your pet back home if it has a multi-drug resistant infection, and you should leave it at the vets. So we do need to make sure that we are advising our clients sensibly, but we certainly shouldn't comment on their own medical issues. Let's look at specific surgical site infections, and let's start off with the gastrointestinal tract, because for me this is the biggest problem in terms of gastrointestinal tract surgery, and also it's the biggest problem in terms of dehiscence that I see. So every time I do an intestinal surgery, I have a very healthy level of paranoia about whether that intestine is going to dehiss. If it happens, it's usually between 3 and 5 days, but I've seen it at 1 day and I've seen it at 7 days. Unfortunately, it means it tends to happen when the owners have gone home. So we talk to them about being vigilant. We give them a discharge note that talks to them about the clinical signs to watch for, and to say, see your vet immediately. Don't dismiss any of these symptoms. The number one clinical sign in a dog with septic peritonitis is vomiting. And if an animal vomits once, we are proactive in going to look for evidence of septic peritonitis. The other clinical signs are variable. Many animals may be depressed in the immediate postoperative period anyway. They may not be eating in the first day or two. But in particular for me, it's a question of looking at change. So septic peritonitis is usually picked up by the nurses in our practice because they say the animal was making a good recovery and something's different about it now, and the dog is not as good this evening as it was this morning. So he may not have enjoyed his walk as much. The pulse rate may have gone up. Sometimes we will even see dripping of fluid from the wound, but that's quite unusual. So if there's anything different about the patient's recovery, again, this is a time to be proactive in looking for septic peritonitis. If I do have my suspicions that an animal is not doing well enough after surgery, then I'll take a minimum database to see if we can identify a problem. And in particular, we are concerned about animals who have low albumin because that's been shown consistently to increase the death rate in animals who have septic peritonitis. So if we see a low albumin, then we will want to consider whether we're going to use plasma or albumin for that animal. Ultrasound is very useful for identifying fluid, and you don't have to be a good ultrasonographer to detect really large volumes of fluid. Even small volumes of fluid can be picked up by those people who don't have a lot of ultrasound experience. And if you personally don't do ultrasound, but there's someone in your practice who does, then it's worth getting some practice in and just trying to work out if you can find the liver and the bladder. So what we have in this dog here, this is liver. And the black next to it is fluid. So it's a typical site for spotting fluid, is next to the liver and also next to the bladder. Now, a small amount of fluid will be present in the postoperative case, and if you're not sure about it, then we would like to sample it. But the other thing you can do is just keep watching the animal. So if you're not sure if the animal's got septic peritonitis but you were worried, then we will follow up 2 hours later. So we send that animal back for another scan. And if the amount of fluid is increased, then your level of suspicion is going to increase. But remember that not every animal who is not doing well after intestinal surgery has septic peritonitis. So we get referred a reasonable number of cases where there's the suspicion of septic peritonitis and they come to us for confirmation and treatment. So I have two main differentials for the animal not doing well after intestinal surgery. The first is that they have ileus. So any trauma or insult to the gastrointestinal tract can induce ileus. In fact, just having surgery can make the gastrointestinal tract stop working. So having intestinal surgery, particularly if there was a dilatation or an obstruction prior to the surgery, will increase our risk of ileus. So that's my major differential for vomiting after intestinal surgery. On ultrasound, the intestines are generally dilated and there's no peristalsis in them. And there's usually just a small amount of fluid just associated with recent surgery. So we should be able to differentiate ileus from septic peritonitis on ultrasound. If we're not sure, as I said earlier, we will rescan again and look for an accumulation of fluid. Remember that you can have ileus and septic peritonitis. We'll treat these medically, so we want to try and get the animals eating if possible, and we'll use drugs to promote gastrointestinal movement, such as ranitidine. We may also see hypotension. So some of the animals who come into us for assessment are depressed, not doing very well, and actually they are just still hypotensive or hypovolemic from their original surgery. So if an animal's not doing well, just give it a bolus of fluids, see whether that makes a difference, and also address the analgesia. And that may be enough to just turn the animals around. But again, remember to keep watching for the septic peritonitis. If you do see an increase in fluid, or even just a small amount of fluid, then we want a sample from it. It can be done blind if there's a very, very large amount of fluid. So we've got a dog here. This dog was in with septic peritonitis. And there's a reasonably large amount of fluid in this dog, but you can see I'm actually struggling to get any out. So I'm just doing my abdominal syntheses at multiple quadrants. So just so you know, this area has all been prepped in advance. And eventually you will see a tiny little bit of fluid come out and we can look at that under the microscope. So this is what we would do in cases where you don't have ultrasound available. If you do have ultrasound available, then it's useful to use that to guide you into fluid pockets. Abdominocentesis in the advanced cases of septic peritonitis is really obvious. You will have lots and lots of degenerate neutrophils and intracellular bacteria. Do bear in mind that any animal that's had recent surgery will have neutrophils, and the absolute number of neutrophils can't differentiate recent surgery from septic peritonitis. It's much more important to look at how the cells look. So if those neutrophils look relatively healthy and you can't see any bacteria present and your dog is clinically well, then hopefully it doesn't have septic peritonitis. If your dog is clinically not doing well and you're not sure, then you may be confident enough to go to surgery, but if you're not confident enough, then I would say tap that fluid again in an hour. Because my experience is animals where you're not quite sure if they're septic or not will be progressing quite quickly, and within an hour or two you will see a change in that fluid. So if we do recognise a septic peritonitis, we have to get the dog stable enough for surgery. We will never get them normovolemic, or if we do, not for long. But we need to make sure that we are not operating when the animal is very, very hypovolemic. So we give fluid therapy via large bore catheters, and usually we will use crystalloids in the first instance. And the approach to fluid therapy now is to use boluses over 10 minutes and then reassess, bolus again if necessary. If we do manage to get our animal normovolemic, then we will still be using high fluid rates. We certainly wouldn't drop back down to maintenance. Make sure the animal is on antibiotics, and we tend to use broad spectrum drugs. So a co-amoxicillin or a cephalosporin will give us activity against most of the gram positives, gram negatives, and the anaerobes. Some people will add in metronidazole as well, and some people add in an aminoglycoside. But we certainly wouldn't use a drug like enrofloxacin or metronidazole alone. Actually, the co-amoxicillin and the cephalosporins are the most broad spectrum. We need to make sure these animals are analgesics, so I would give them an opioid, but I don't use non-steroidals initially because the animal will be hypovolemic. So the goal of the surgery, we need to explore the abdomen, find where the infection is coming from, and then find a way of controlling that infection. And then we need to lavage, so we need to use high volumes of fluid so that we can actually flush all of that contamination away, so we need a suction machine available. And then we need to think about ongoing drainage. So for most of my septic peritonitis, I have to say I do tend to close them up. It's very rare that I will use open peritoneal drainage, but it is useful to start thinking about using catheters, and so there's a nice paper recently about the use of Jackson Pratt catheters, so that potentially you could lavage the abdomen without having to open it up again, but also you can take fluid samples and see whether the septic peritonitis is redeveloping. And then always remember nutrition for these patients. If they've had septic peritonitis, they often won't be eating afterwards, and we can improve the health of the intestine by enteral feeding. Most of our septic peritonitis cases are gastrointestinal, so 60% of all septic peritonitis comes to the GI tract, and 50% of all septic peritonitises are post-operative cases, again, most of which are GI. So most of the time, if we have a septic peritonitis case, we're dealing with the intestine. So this is a dog who'd had a foreign body removed and has had an enterotomy, and you can see an obvious area of dehiscence here, possibly dehiscence there, and you can see where the suture line is not intact anymore. If I can, then I will repair an enterotomy, but I do have to feel that the wound edges are very healthy. So in this case, we can trim away the slightly inflamed areas and then be able to replace new sutures. So we just have a little video here of this dog being sutured closed. So I will always use a 4-knot suture material. My personal preference is a long-acting suture, so I use PDS. And we need to make sure that we engage the submucosa layer of the intestine to reduce the chances of further dehiscence. And you can either do a simple interrupted or a simple continuous technique. They are as leak-proof as each other, as long as the technique we use is correct. And we need to make sure that we have our sutures far enough away from the edge of the wound so that we don't have pull through of that suture. If the suture is too close to the edge of the wound, then we can end up with it cheese wiring through. I personally like to leak test my enterotomy and enterectomy sites afterwards. They will identify if you have large holes in them. If you put too much fluid in, then any suture line will leak. But if, for example, there was a gap between two of your sutures and you saw a little gush of fluid coming out of it, then you would know to place another suture in between here. My personal preference is 2 to 3 millimeters apart for my sutures. Textbooks do say up to 5 millimeters apart, but generally if I go 5 millimeters apart, I usually find I just have to end up adding extra sutures, and 3 to 5 millimeters from the wound edge. Most people place their sutures far too close to the wound edge, and that will increase the risk of suture pull-through and dehiscence. So this dog healed well after the first surgery initially, but then suffered a second wound break and a breakdown and a septic peritonitis. So he went back in and had an enterectomy. And this is him 2 months later when he ate another foreign body, rather unhelpfully. So he had another intestinal repair. But we were able to go and have a look at the original surgery site. So we can see here's the scar from the previous enterectomy. And you can see how the omentum is very good at sticking to wounds and helping us with our healing. If you have taken a case to surgery with septic peritonitis, make sure you change your gloves. We want to reduce contamination if we've been suturing the bowel. So I would do this after any planned intestinal surgery or any septic peritonitis. So we've got new gloves on and then a new drape so that when we're moving our hands around and placing our instruments on the drape, then we're not going to contaminate our surgical sites. We're going to reduce the risk of getting a surgical site infection of our linear alba. In the postoperative period, there's not a lot of detail, not a lot of time to go into detail here, but we're particularly looking for any evidence that the animal is hypovolemic, any other problems that may be arising, hypothermia, problems with the ECG, and potentially any changes that may suggest another bout of septic peritonitis. So in the immediate postoperative period, it's very useful for these animals to have a nurse sit with them or to be checking them at least every hour. Points to consider when we're treating septic peritonitis: can the underlying cause be treated? So we may have different requests from the owners if there's a septic peritonitis secondary to enterectomy for gastrointestinal neoplasia versus a foreign body, because obviously the long-term prognosis will be different. So that's something to bear in mind. Also think about the prognosis for survival after septic peritonitis. We need to know what the owner's expectations are and also their financial commitments, because unfortunately septic peritonitis is a lot more expensive to treat than the original intestinal surgery. Mortality rate is somewhere between 30 to 50%, depending upon the study. And sadly, the mortality rates haven't desperately improved in recent decades. So despite the advances in emergency and critical care and surgery, we're not seeing a general improvement in survival. A few key points then from septic peritonitis. Differentials for any animal who has hypovolemic or shock should be an acute abdomen and septic peritonitis. We don't ignore vomiting in an animal who's had abdominal surgery. That's often our first sign of the septic peritonitis, so we need to go and look with cytology, and a single intracellular bacterium is diagnostic for septic peritonitis. So in those cases we need to stabilize the patient and surgically explore the abdomen, and we might want to consider referral because these can be challenging cases and very, very time consuming to manage. The other area I wanted to talk about in terms of dehiscence is the linear alba. Fortunately, we don't see many cases of dehiscence, but we have to anticipate them, even with the spays, because they will sometimes occur. So this animal has a little bit of dehiscence, so she's come in with a bandage in place, and you can see a little bit of opening at the caudal end of this abdominal incision. We can also see the discharge associated with it. And if we take this animal to surgery, it's a slightly more zoomed in view, we can see that as well as a skin dehiscence, we're going to see that there's dehiscence of the linear alba as well. So it looks intact at this stage, so the animal hadn't eviscerated. But if you see the surgical video here, let's wait for that to come up. What we're going to find is that the body is really attempting to close that wound itself, very possibly may well have done so. We may not have noticed that this was a linear alba dehiscence if it hadn't been for the fact that the skin had dehisced as well and we had discharge. So you can see, I just used my finger here to separate the granulation tissue that was forming, and then we are entering the abdominal cavity. So if that little piece of tissue had broken down, then we may have found that we had movement of the guts out through the linear alba, and because there was a hole in the skin, we may well have found that that patient eviscerated. But the dog did well after us, and we were just able to do a routine closure. This animal's been less fortunate because there has been an evisceration, but the dog actually did it in the waiting room, so we were able to treat this dog promptly. So you can see that a bandage had just very, very quickly been applied to cover the intestines while the animal was anaesthetized. And you can see here they are outside of the body. We've got one veterinary surgeon wearing gloves here, just ready to pick up those intestines, just give them a lavage and replace them back into the abdomen. So here they're going back in prior to now getting this animal ready for surgery. And so here he is waiting to be now clipped and cleaned up and then taken through to the operating theatre, where the surgical incision has been increased. So this was the area that had dehisced. We're going to increase the skin incision because we were aware at the time of this surgery that actually the linear alba dehiscence is a lot more prolonged. My experience generally is that a linear alba dehiscence will go on to heal the second time. I generally don't use meshes to reinforce. Just need to be very, very careful to make sure the sutures are well placed. So here was the dog after surgery, and this wound went on to heal normally. We've got another example here of a fully healed piece of skin. We've got some tissue coming through here. And we tend to operate on these because of the concern of the intestines moving through a little hernia. But in this case, all we have is movement of omentum through the little hole. So we're going to reset that omentum, find that actually that wound is quite small, and we can just do a primary repair on the linear alba there. And then finally we have seromas. Seromas are pretty common really. We'll sometimes see them in specific locations such as in the neck. So if I do a tie back surgery, it pretty much will always get a seroma. Anywhere where we've been undermining and there's dead space. So if you've taken a tumour out, you may see dead space. And then sometimes we'll just see them associated with spay wounds. So this dog has a really large seroma after her spay. We know it's a seroma because if we do cytology on it, we will see non-degenerate neutrophils with a low cell count and no bacteria. So we can do an aspirate just to make sure that we don't have an abscess formed. Most of the time I don't operate. I will usually let seromas resolve by themselves. I don't drain them because unfortunately if you drain them, you will increase the risk of developing an infection from repeated drainage, but also seromas form in the presence of a dead space. So if you drain the seroma, the dead space remains and it just fills back up again. But this dog had failed to resolve the seroma. You see it's pretty large but forming a nice shape. So we take this dog to surgery and we manage them by placing drains. So here she is with just a little incision into one side of the seroma. We let the fluid drain out using a suction machine if we've got that available. And then we're going to place a drain. Personally, I prefer active suction drains because they don't rely on gravity and they're a lot easier and cleaner to manage afterwards. So in this dog, I'm placing a Jackson Pratt drain. It's a very, very soft drain with a lot of fenestrations. And I'm choosing to exit it from a different location just so that I can get a very, very tight seal around the tubing so that when we apply the vacuum to the drain, then it will actually drain the seroma. If we have leakage around the edge of that drain, then it won't work very well. So we're just going to close the defect from where we went in and drained it. And you can see here we've got a bottle drain attached to the tubing. So here's our bottle drain, which is going to apply suction. And then we apply a dressing just to try and compress where the seroma was. And then it's useful to use these little string vests to hold the tubing in place. So this is how an active suction drain works. We're attaching, this is a different dog, but we're attaching the drain and we're turning the bottle on. And as it applies the vacuum, you'll be able to see that the fluid runs into the bottle. You can see it running in here. So it's a very, very effective means of applying constant drainage. If it fails, then eventually I will resort to using a Mentum. So here we have a Mentum that's exited a linear alba incision and that's gone down to treat a seroma in the inguinal area. This is the dog that I showed you earlier on. So this is the dog who's had a seroma treated. You can still see a little bit of seroma there in the postoperative period, but hopefully that bit will resolve by itself. Another alternative is a use of a Penrose drain. So here we have a dog with a nasty elbow wound that's being treated with a thoracodorsal axial pattern flap. We anticipate seroma formation because there's a lot of dead space here, so we're using a couple of active suction drains. But despite that, seroma formation has occurred when the suction drains have been removed, and that risks the suture line opening up, and so we've placed a little Penrose drain at the distal end of that flap. And so that leg's going to be wrapped up and that Penrose drain resolved the seroma. This dog shows you a reason why we need to think about keeping our seromas under control in areas where the wounds are tight. So this is a dog who has a sarcoma. It's going to be removed. There's a wide area of resection here. And we have a large defect, but that was closed primarily and an active suction drain was placed to try and resolve any fluid that formed. However, the suction drain got blocked, stopped working, and the dog developed a seroma, and a seroma that was pushing against what was already a slightly tight wound did lead to wound dehiscence and necrosis. So that's the reason we want to make sure seromas don't develop. Just a couple of final points before we finish. Regurgitation will happen periodically under anaesthesia. If it does, then we want to suction and lavage the mouth and esophagus so that we don't have any acid sitting in the area. We can give medication to reduce regurgitation becoming repeated, so we can use omeprazole or ranitidine. And the reason we want to avoid chronic regurgitation is because it can ultimately result in this. So this is nasopharyngeal stenosis. So that dog had chronic regurgitation for about a month after a routine anaesthetic and had quite severe esophageal and nasopharyngeal stenosis and had to undergo quite a lot of ballooning episodes to resolve it and ultimately had the nasopharyngeal stenosis stented. So it can be very expensive to resolve these complications, so we try to get on top of regurgitation as soon as it happens. So this was another dog with a similar problem, being ballooned. And then just finally, we can resolve our complication rate for some of our cases by making sure that we feed them well. So we can reduce the risk of gastrointestinal dehiscence by making sure that an animal has enteral nutrition, but also we will need to think about including alimentation and feeding in any of our animals that have suffered a complication. So an animal who's had septic peritonitis is unlikely to want to eat in the postoperative period. We may have animals who have got wound dehiscences that are having sedations or anaesthetics every day for wound lavage, and those animals may either not want to eat or actually not have enough hours in the day when they're either not having procedures done or being starved ready for a procedure to be able to eat. So in those animals, we will place an esophagostomy tube quite early on in the course of treatment and make sure that our animals are well nourished. So complications from esophagostomy tubes are quite rare. It is possible to damage the jugular or the carotid artery in placing it, but that would be quite unusual. The biggest problems really that I see will be actually just problems with the stoma, so infection or discharge from the stoma. And if that occurs, actually we can just remove the tubes. So esophagostomy tubes are relatively easy to place. The animal just needs a brief period of anaesthetic to get that placed. We generally do it with an anaesthetic rather than sedation, and it can either be placed at the same time as another surgical procedure that's being done to manage a complication, or it may be done as an individual procedure for a particular complication. So we might want to put an esophagostomy tube in a dog who's having wound management because we've found that maybe over a period of a couple of days he or she hasn't eaten well enough. So esophagostomy tubes are very well managed. They're a lot easier to put in than PEG tubes and surgically placed gastrostomy tubes. They're cheaper to place, they're easier to place, and they're a little bit easier to manage. If anyone's interested in investigating this a bit further, there's a new book out called Complications in Small Animal Surgery that's worth reading. And obviously there's a lot of information in textbooks about individual surgical types and the complications that may occur with them. Okay, so that's all we had. Sorry, we've run on a little bit. And I'm happy to see if there are any questions. Okay, so first question that's come up was pertaining to the retained ovaries and what were the specific lab tests that you can use. So I would probably use the LH levels. You can look at progesterone. It can be high after a season, but it's best really only in the first 2 weeks after a season. And so often I'll find owners want to know what's going on when the animal is maybe a month after the season. So we look at the LH levels. In a spayed animal, it will always be high. If there's any ovarian tissue, the LH will always be low, apart from just after the animal's ovulated. So if you have a high result, we would test it again a couple of days later. And if it's low and it's persistently low, then we'll say that that animal's got ovarian tissue present. The other question was, how do you sew the linear alba closed in an animal who's had a dehiscence? Would you use simple interrupted sutures, and what suture pattern would you use? So I will often still use a simple continuous suture if I think the linear alba is healthy. Many of the dehiscences will occur from just snapping of the suture material if it's been handled incorrectly, rather than the suture tearing through the tissues. So I'm still usually confident that I can still place a simple continuous suture as long as I use a suture such as PDS. You can't use Vicryl as a simple continuous suture because it doesn't last long enough. But if I was in doubt about the integrity of the linear alba, then I would probably do some simple interrupted sutures. And I don't see any other questions, so unless any more pop up, then I'd like to bring the presentation to a close and thank you for your time.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Alison for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.